Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. I'm Susan Lee Bell at St. Joseph's University, and today I welcome Drs. Robert P. Saldine and Stephen B. Tellis to discuss their new book, Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. The book uses interviews with 62 conservative elites who oppose Donald Trump's presidency. The authors unpack the varying motives and methods, degrees of intensity, and approaches to resistance among conservative elites. Saldine and Tellis provide a nuanced assessment of Never Trump, both successes and failures, to reflect on the long-term consequences for both parties, conservatism, and the mechanics of the American constitutional system. Robert P. Saldine is professor of political science and a Mansfield Fellow at the University of Montana. And Stephen M. Tellis is professor of political science at the Johns Hopkins University and a senior fellow at the Naskanen Center. They both published extensively in their fields as well as for distinguished popular outlets like the Washington Post and National Review, and I'm pleased to welcome them both to the podcast.
Good to be here, Susan. Thanks.
Thanks for having me.
So first, tell me a little bit about how this book ties to your previous work in American politics and the decision to collaborate. Rob, why don't you start us off?
Well, the way Steve and I got connected in the first place is that Steve is the editor of a series at Oxford University Press on post-war American political development, and that's the series that my second book came out with, and so we were kind of in discussion, in communication around the release of that book. And Steve was asking, well, you know, what are you thinking about doing next? And I said, well, I'm kind of fascinated by this Never Trump phenomenon. This was just right after the 2016 election. And so I'm thinking about doing something similar to what I did in the previous book, which is a lot of elite level interviews of these Never Trumpers. And Steve wrote back and said, hey, I know a lot about that. And interviews is a method that Steve has used a lot in the past too. And so it did kind of nicely grow out of that. And of course, Steve has done a lot on conservatives and the conservative movement.
Yeah, I mean, conservatives, you know, Carmen Miranda famously said that bananas is my business and conservatives is sort of my business in political science. I had written a couple of previous books focusing on conservative elites. One, probably my best known book, The Rise of the Conservative Legal Movement, was based on extensive interviewing as well as archival material. I wrote a more recent book with David Dagon called Prison Break on Why Conservatives Were Changing Their Mind on Mass Incarceration. And the other thing that I think worth mentioning is both Rob and I studied at different times at the University of Virginia, where we actually had at least one conservative advisor in Jim Caesar, as well as some others. And I think that has given both of us probably a little more entree into that particular part of the conservative world than most people in political science have.
Tell me a little bit about the method. You have a list of the people that you interviewed in the back. Were these in person? Were they by phone? And how did you create this list of the 9 women and 53 men that you talked to? You also obtained emails and other correspondence. Tell me a little bit about how that worked.
Yeah, I'll take that to start out with. So method might be a little gilding the lily. If you want to use technical terms, we could say that some of this was snowball sampling. We interviewed a lot of the people who were in this were people who were very out front. They'd been publishing, they'd been identifying themselves with Never Trump. It should be admitted that the basic structure of the book, in divided into professional groupings, didn't really come together until fairly late in the process, I think. I think that's when we realized that that was the principal organizing structure of these networks, and that really made sense of a lot of what was going on. So we started with the most visible people, and then in some cases people suggested that we needed to go and talk to somebody else. So there was some snowball sampling. And so we mostly kept going down the list until we felt like we had sort of made sense of each of these professional networks.
Was there a person who you very much wanted to interview that would not grant an interview? Were there people that fit the definition of what you wanted, but that were not accessible?
Well, there were certainly some people who we didn't interview. I mean, Max Boot is one, and on the foreign policy side, and the public intellectual too. We could have gone back and interviewed a handful of other people, but I think a couple things are worth pointing out. This is a relatively small world, and so it's not like it's a sprawling thing where there are just thousands and thousands of people, at least in the way that we conceive of Never Trump as being an elite party phenomenon. We aren't looking at it as something out there in the electorate. So it is a fairly identifiable group of people. And then just to piggyback on what Steve was saying, I mean, part of what we were trying to do was understand it in terms of these professional networks, which we think is so important to understanding the Never Trump phenomenon. And, you know, after you do a bunch of interviews with these folks, you just get diminishing returns in terms of trying to talk to every single last person. So, you know, what we tried to do is get go after all the obvious people, and then as we got further into it, try to hit some of the people that you get led to, or that, you know, people say, hey, you really got to talk to so and so. But we do feel like we got a really good sample, so to speak, within each of these little orbits that we discuss in the book.
Yeah. And the last thing I'll just say on that is we, unlike a lot of political science or social science work, we did really feel the press of time. And, you know, in retrospect, I wish we'd gotten it done even a little earlier, but we did want to get this out. So this was a little bit more like real time social science. And at the margin where we did feel like there were declining marginal returns, that's where we decided to emphasize, you know, getting it out while people were still really interested in the topic over complete sort of exhausting every possible angle.
Well, and I'd maybe say one thing.
No, you go ahead. Oh, you go ahead.
Yeah, and just one other final point. You know, we found, I think somewhat to my surprise, that most people, and there were a couple exceptions, but most people were pretty eager to talk with us. We didn't have too many people say no or just not respond to our requests. You know, sometimes it took several requests, but you know, most people got back immediately and were very happy to tell their story.
So one of the important reasons for getting this book out would be that in a lot of ways it confronts a narrative of the Never Trumpers as just failures. But you really want to explore why these men and women, all party loyalists, would oppose their own nominee. And you argue that that they felt obligated to do so as individuals, sometimes in a kind of an idiosyncratic way, but that they thought that their roles in the party, their part in this profession, entitled them to this opposition. So let's get to who the Never Trumpers are. Many of the listeners know, but I think you define it and talk about it in a way that's far more nuanced. So who are they?
So in the book, we use the concept that we draw from Andrew Abbott's book, on the sociology of professions, the concept of jurisdiction, that what makes a profession is they feel like is those that group has jurisdiction over expert work. And that what defines this group is that at least up until 2016, they had a relatively well-defined jurisdiction over a particular piece of expert work in the party, right? The national security conservatives had jurisdiction over advising candidates, over staffing most of the positions in the national security infrastructure. The political professionals had jurisdiction over not just campaigns, but over overall electoral strategy. Public intellectuals, which is a sort of vaguer and more nebulous group, still thought they had a kind of jurisdiction over preserving the general ideological cleanliness and purity of the campaigns of the party's message. And so when you think about who these people were, they're really defined by those specific jurisdictions that they had. And in the book, we argue that their opposition to Trump was in part justified in their own minds by that jurisdiction. They thought they were authorized, that it in some sense was their job to do this. And then in individuals, there are also idiosyncratic stories that in some cases have to do with religion that I think turned out to be pretty important in explaining why some of these people felt so strongly that they needed to oppose Trump even at some degree of professional risk.
Yeah, no, and that's a fascinating part of the book that I definitely want to take up later in our conversation. Rob, please, other things about who the Never Trumpers are. Steve has said that who they think they are and the role that they think they play, is that any different from the actual influence they have over voters, journalists, the government, et cetera?
Well, yeah. So I think there was always a little bit of a disconnect there. But and in fact, that's one of the things that became quite apparent. I mean, the national security folks, which is kind of the group against which all the other groups are measured in our account, because that was just such an internally cohesive group in a way that the others were not. But you know, one of the things that Trump realized is that those national security people, for as prominent a role as they've played in previous Republican administrations and Republican campaigns, they don't command an army of voters out there, right? And so he went straight at them during the campaign. In fact, very clearly told them, you will have no part in my campaign. You will have no part in the Trump administration. Really went right after their jurisdiction, and clearly that's not something that resonates very deeply with voters, right? So he kind of recognized that there was that disconnect, and I guess the only other thing I'd say in general about how we think of the Never Trumpers is that, you know, we do think of it as basically a phenomenon that took place within these people who provide these important services to the party, right? So we are not talking about elected officials, right? And you know, there were a handful in that space, Mitt Romney, most obviously, But the white hot core of the Never Trump phenomenon was not with elected officials. In our account, it was not with voters out there in the mass public. It was with these service providers, these people who provide really important services to the party. That's where the real action was.
And your claim, if I got it right, is that it's more than providing a function to the party, but it's also a function of a political function of balance in the American liberal democratic system. And that somebody like Trump, who was running on populism, which would put him at odds with elites to begin with, is in some way threatening this balance. And that's part of what the elites believe that they're doing is as a corrective. Is that correct?
So we draw on the work of Daniel Ziblatt and Steve Levitsky on this, basically arguing that in a liberal democracy, especially on the right, and this draws on Ziblatt's book on conservative parties and the consolidation of democracy, that conservative parties in particular need to, in some ways, insulate themselves from the worst extremes of populism by, in a way, house training some of those instincts to both bring them into the political system so that they're not entirely outside it, but then to make them safe for liberal democracy. And I do think a lot of these elites that we're talking about in Never Trump saw Trump as violating that particular kind of guardrail of liberal democracy. And I think that explains, again, a lot of why they opposed him. The other thing that I think is really important to emphasize here is that, and it's hard to remember this now, was how broad the belief that Trump was going to lose was for pretty much the entire campaign up until Election Day. And so there were many people who were involved in Never Trump who also, who disliked Trump for a lot of reasons, but partially disliked him because they thought he was going to be dragging the party down into the ditch. And they were trying to save their party from what they thought was going to be a terrible defeat. And so I think that's also worth keeping in mind. And that also explains, again, why some of these people ended up, as we say, being sunshine patriots.
And it's a theme that runs throughout the book, because many of the people that you are interviewing talk about their motives through the lens of imagining that Hillary Clinton's lead was enough and that she would be the next president. And so therefore the strategy was based on that, which is a fascinating part of the narrative. I know that you wrote the book together, but that some parts of it were initially drafted by one author. So I'll turn to Rob to talk about the national security professionals. It's the first part of the book. It sets up the rest of the narrative, as you said earlier, by providing this contrast. So Rob, can you tell us a little bit about the foreign policy establishment, who they are, where they came from, and how you see them, or they see themselves as guardians?
Yeah, right. So the National Security Network is, we think, unique for a number of reasons. For one thing, so many of these people are based in Washington, D.C. They know each other. They socialize together. There are institutions out there like the Council on Foreign Relations that hosts a lot of various types of events that puts these people into conversation with one another. And not just on the Republican side, right? There's a lot of stuff out there that gets Democrats and Republicans to interact with one another. So the point is the whole so-called foreign policy establishment, it's a pretty tight circle, and it's very heavily based in D.C. So these people are always interacting with one another. And in general, Yeah, you know, and you can probably overstate this to some degree, but you know, there it's just a less partisan group, right? We kept hearing this again and again from these never Trumpers in the national security space that they kind of see partisan politics as just a little icky, right? It's something that you have to put up with because that's how the game is played. But if they had it their way, you know, they want to focus on policy, not party politics. You know, one of the other things, I mentioned this earlier, but this was the group that was just so internally cohesive, much more so than some of the other groups we looked at. But for this group, the people who did not get on board as never Trumpers, who chose not to sign these group letters that they put out opposing Trump, you know, the words that were used to describe those people who refused to denounce Trump, I mean, words like traitor and stuff, and those words carry a really important meaning for those people, right? These aren't just words that you kind of idly throw around, and we think that that cohesion that they had kind of is a function of the fact again that all these people know each other. They run in the same circles. You know, it's not like the world of political professionals where people are scattered all over the place, and you know, most of them don't know one another. So you mentioned the Guardian mentality, right? And we think this is something that kind of crops up from just this the fact that these people are all networked together, and cross partisan too. And one of the things we heard a lot from our interviews was that, you know, the Republicans we spoke with kind of talked about one of their roles as in conjunction with their counterparts on the Democratic side as keeping the crazies at bay, right? And the and it's a slightly different type of crazy that you find on the right and on the left, but part of the way in which they viewed their role was to push back on the Republican side against populism and nationalism and xenophobia and some of these things. But right, that was one of the jobs that these people were supposed to do, and their counterparts on the Democratic side played a similar role with people on the far left of the Democratic Party. But they very much saw themselves as see themselves as people who have this responsibility to keep things centered and stable, and that is in their eyes something that they very much work together with their Democratic counterparts to ensure.
Do we have an example at another time where the national security professionals would be as public with a published letter against the nominee from one of the two major parties? Is there any sort of parallel in the past?
Certainly not like this. We don't get too deep into historical parallels. I mean, yeah, you know, we spent a little time looking at that, and there was certainly a group of Republicans in 1964, for instance, who weren't happy with Goldwater and organized to a degree around that. 72 on the Democratic side, but certainly nothing like this on the national security side, where really it was really hard to find people in the national security space who were not opposed to Trump. So I do think that's unprecedented.
Maybe you also say, I'm sorry, go ahead.
This is Rob, but just maybe one other thing I'd note on the national security side. One of the things that helps inform those two chapters are a series of emails that we got access to when one of these letters was being shopped around. We were able to get the email exchange, so we could see, you know, how people were responding at the time, rather than just with the benefit of hindsight and looking back on it. And that was a fascinating thing, and it really did draw out the extent to which that network has this internal cohesion and a sense of duty and mission, and they see themselves again as these guardians. But and you also see in that and a lot of this we were able to quote from those emails. We don't ascribe them to particular people, but we were allowed to quote from them extensively. You do see the real hostility and venom that the core group had to the handful of people who, for whatever reason, decided that they weren't going to go public with their opposition to Trump.
No, and in that section, the language, the idea of these people being Vichy collaborators, these are people who would collaborate with Nazis. I mean, for people who do foreign policy, that is a third rail word to use. And what I also thought was fascinating about this chapter is that the objection of the foreign policy establishment doesn't seem to be the direction of Trump's potential foreign policy as much as it is to something about his character and his suitability for office.
Yeah, I just want to get in on that one. I mean, I do think this is important. Now, there were a number of people who were genuinely disturbed by the direction that Trump was proposing, taking the substance of foreign policy. And I do think that's important. But when there's a great quote by Phil Zelikow, who's now at Virginia, but before had served on the George W. Bush administration, where he says, you know, the lives of people who do national security are made up by, you know, funerals and parades, right? And the sort of ritual quality of government service is very important to them. And the fact that Trump seemed to have, you know, to treat those kinds of things in such a incredibly dismissive manner, I think really did bother these people, right? They really did think that authority flowed from the top and that they needed to actually respect the commander in chief. And when you talk to some of the lawyers, which we talk about later, they often talk about the fact that, you know, they're comfortable having clients that they don't respect. And I think that's a fundamental difference between these professional groups.
Rob, did you want to say something else about the foreign policy establishment before we move to the political operatives?
No, I don't think so. Steve, did we miss any key points there?
No, I think that covers it.
Yeah. Okay. No, they're such an interesting group, and you do a very nice job of creating a very nuanced picture of the group. Now, when it comes to the pack animals, and you use a lot of animal imagery here, they're deer in the headlights, et cetera. You say, and I'm just going to read it, despite near universal, albeit largely silent, opposition to Trump initially, most operatives dutifully fell in line once he became the presumptive nominee. Yet the small minority within the political operative world that refused to make their peace with him emerged as one of the brightest constellations in the never Trump universe. And I was wondering, Rob, you wrote this chapter or the first version of this chapter, so maybe you'll start us off. Who are the pack animals and how are they, why did so few of them join Never Trump as opposed to the foreign policy folks? And what are some of the contrasts between the two groups?
Right. So the group of people we have in mind here are basically all the people who run campaigns. And you're talking about, you know, thousands of people across the country, you know, the kind of top tier celebrity consultant types like Mike Murphy and Stu Stevens, you know, on down to the people who run, you know, local campaigns. You know, the thing that I think really stands out about this network is that this is the group that is just most dependent on staying in the good graces of the Republican Party for their livelihood, right? This is the way they pay their mortgage. And that's a real contrast to like the national security types, right? All these national security types that we talk to you know, they have other ways to make a living and to be fulfilled professionally, right? They can go back to their think tank gig or their university professorship, or you know, go back to their magazine or whatever. But these people who work in the trenches of political campaigns, right? They don't have those kinds of alternative opportunities, and so one of the things that became clear is that the opposition to Trump early on in this group was nearly universal. But as it became increasingly clear that Trump was going to win the nomination, you know, people have to get in line because their jobs are at stake here. And so in this orbit, right, unlike the national security types, where it was nearly totally unified within the world of political operatives, political professionals, it was such that by the end, those who went never Trump and stuck with it were really the minority. And it was this group, I think, that felt in some ways the most abandoned. And it was a traumatic experience for some of them. Now, one of the things that helps explain, well, who stuck never Trump and who crawled back into the fold, is that and this by no means is the case for every single one, but in general, I think the ones who were the prominent never Trumpers and who remain prominent never Trumpers, right? A lot of these people behind the Lincoln Project and Republican Voters Against Trump. Going on right now, come out of this political operative world. But the ones who stuck with the never Trump thing are the ones who had more flexibility, right? These are people who had made a lot of money running Republican campaigns. And so the idea of taking a hit professionally just wasn't as big a deal as it was for some people earlier in their careers or who were just, you know, your average run of the mill political professional, as opposed to these people who'd worked at the very highest levels of, you know, run presidential campaigns and things of this nature. Right. So they had alternative ways to make money, or they just didn't really need to be worried about paying their mortgage at this point in their lives. And so I think that's one of the things that really stands out about and defines the political pros that we discuss.
Despite the fact that all, as you describe it so eloquently, their self-interest was in the direction of continuing to play the role as media expert and pollster, despite that, much of this section of the book is taken up with a mid-level political consultant, Joel Searby from Florida, who had founded a consulting firm, going out and trying to find somebody to run against Trump as an independent candidate. So despite all of that, the two people, and he's later joined by William Crystal. So how do you explain that Searby and Crystal end up doing this despite their interests? And can you also tell us a little bit about what it is that they go and try to do?
Sure. Yeah. Well, and Searby is definitely one of those people who paid a real price. And there are a number of them. But yet, you know, I guess maybe just in general, we could say this in general about the Never Trumpers. For many of them, and this is not the case with all, but for many of them, this was a really traumatic experience. It ended up costing some of them professionally. But it was also, just something that in some cases shattered their own conception of who they were and what they were doing and why they were doing it. Some of them, you know, felt this sense of being betrayed and finding surprise to find themselves alone in the foxhole. And so on all these different levels for some of these, and again, this to some degree that varies by professional network, but it was certainly the case with a lot of the, with the party professionals. Searby was kind of this mid-level, political pro who ran campaigns in Florida. And yet, you know, his story, I think, does highlight one thing that's important to note. You know, we spend a lot of time identifying, you know, structural issues and these professional network issues that help us to explain and understand Never Trump. But there's also there is also just an element of personal choice. And David Frum had a nice way of putting it, I think, when he said it. On some level, it just comes down to, you know, can you swallow the toad or can you not? And that's going to just vary individually from person to person. And I think, you know, Searby is an example of this. You know, he's somebody who paid a big price and who recognized that he very well may be paying a big price and nonetheless forged ahead. So, But Searby is absolutely a pivotal person in our account, and this search for the third party candidate is a big part of what was going on in this political professional world, and Searby was a ringleader for that. He first tried to get Condoleezza Rice to run. He'd done some polling to try to identify, you know, who's gonna be the best person to run as an independent candidate, and Condi Rice was at the top of his list, and he basically cold called her and all the borderline harassed her and her chief of staff for a number of weeks, and finally was told hell no. But then at some point he got linked up with Bill Kristol, who of course has a long, long history in Republican Party politics and the conservative movement. And they, along with Rick Wilson, another political operative out of Florida, went about trying to woo somebody to run against Trump and Hillary. And they went after Mitt Romney. They went after Ben Sasse. Went after Jim Mattis. And all of these people, those three anyway, Condoleezza Rice, it's not clear that she seriously considered it. But the other three, you know, took meetings with this group and took some time to think about it, you know, and ultimately declined to do it. One of the big reasons, and Steve alluded to this earlier, is that, you know, all of these decisions were being made in the context of the certainty that Hillary Clinton was going to win. And so that really shaped the decision making process for those folks. And you know, after those big first four possibilities, the search process for an alternative candidate it quickly devolved. And you know, the number of people they talked to about it is extensive. We list a whole bunch of them in the book, but they finally settled on Evan McMullen, who you know, very few people had heard of prior to his run for president. He'd been a Capitol Hill staffer. He'd been a CIA agent before that. You know, that was one where they had some shots at getting a high profile candidate, and it just didn't work out. And it's possible, with the benefit of hindsight, if people had taken a little bit more seriously the idea that, you know, Hillary Clinton might not win, that could have changed things. But as it was, they ended up with Evan McMullen. And a lot of these same people tried to recruit a candidate this go around too.
Steve, you wanted to also say something about the operatives and the search for the independent candidate.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think more broadly, one of the things that I think is hard in a book like this is to tease out the difference between self-interest and conviction. And, you know, the methods we have are what they are. But again, I think going back to that point about most people thinking they were going to lose, that I think part of, if you think about this self-interested or moderately self-interested motive here, was that a lot of people talked about the idea that they would be sort of the clean team, right? After this debacle, which again, everyone assumed would be a debacle, that they would be able to come in and fumigate the place and they would be the ones to make the Republican Party a sanitary party again. And so it's a little hard to know, right? You know, most people didn't think there was a very high probability of Trump winning. So it wasn't like they were thinking when they were doing this that they were doing some sort of kamikaze mission. They thought that that in some ways this actually might position them to have more influence after the election. And so I think that's a tricky thing in a book like this to do, is to sort out how much was people having a deep moral conviction, how much was this calculation based on the very limited information that people were operating with.
No, and I think you do a very nice job because of the way you juxtapose their words about their own actions and your analysis as you go. I think that that tension comes out for the reader. And I think it's an important one, especially in a book that is relying on the ad hoc analysis of the people involved, with the exception of the emails, which of course are in the moment. Before we move to the public intellectuals, Rob, let me just ask you about Jim Mattis. He was very much interested, and you show him as very interested and very concerned. Why did he not run?
Well, I think there were a number of reasons. Everyone knew Hillary was going to win. And so I think that just can't be overstated. And, you know, if that's your understanding of the situation, that really changes what that kind of candidacy would mean, right? It's you're kind of betraying the party, and you're also setting yourself up to be blamed by Trump supporters for stealing the election or throwing it to Hillary Clinton. And so I think that's just something that can't be overstated, right? If people had taken seriously the idea that Trump could win, things just would have looked very different.
Steve, let's talk a little bit about the public intellectuals. This part of the book is so rich and so interesting. So let's start with, what were the institutional, the material factors in conservative public intellectuals' role, and how did that influence their response to candidate Trump?
Yeah, I mean, one thing to note about public intellectuals is, again, just materially, they're organized differently than some of these other groups. And I do think there's an important distinction to be made between public intellectuals who are operating within mainstream journalistic kind of institutions and people who are operating inside of conservative controlled organizations. And that's an important distinction we make in the book. One thing to say is that especially for people who are operating inside of places like the New York Times, the Washington Post, that a certain set of conservatives thought of their job as in part being kind of like evangelists for conservatism and people whose job was to explain and to justify conservatives to a non-conservative audience, right? And so those are people you think of like Ross Douthat or Jen Rubin or people like that. And they often, you know, had a very deep dislike of American liberalism, and yet they also saw their job as talking largely to a liberal audience. And Trump was very problematic for what they saw as their project, right? Their project of trying to argue that conservatism wasn't fundamentally racist, wasn't fundamentally, stupid, just to put it bluntly, but was a serious intellectual project that people needed to take seriously. And so Trump was, violated everything they thought they believed about what conservatism ought to be and their own professional project of justifying it to liberals. Now, places like National Review, which we talk about quite a bit, were a somewhat different story. I think one thing that's important to recognize there is that National Review had had a sort of very profound running conflict with the alt-right going pretty far back in its history. And so many people who were involved in National Review saw Trump and saw the fact that so many of these figures in the alt-right were gravitating to him and processed Trump through that ongoing fight they had been having with parts of conservatism that they had, they thought they had sort of pushed to the margins. And so I think that explains why they were so strongly reactive to him, even as many of them had some sympathies with some of the things that that Trump was arguing.
Throughout the book, you talk about mediums of communication and the hashtag, for example, Never Trump that comes out, or Never French, which for the possible David French as one of the independent candidates. And in the chapter on public intellectuals, you reflect on how these changes in communication may have affected some of the long-term voices in conservative politics. And I was wondering if you or both of you would reflect a little bit on the mediums of communication that are used by all of the groups in the book, but particularly the public intellectuals.
Yeah, I mean, this came up a lot in the public intellectuals chapter, where they talk very clearly about themselves as having this sort of purification role, right? That they were in some ways like the priests whose job was to distinguish between the ritually clean and the ritually impure, and that the previous forms of communication and media and other things gave them a kind of pinch point where they could simply say that certain kinds of ideas were beyond the pale. And if Bill Buckley, pushed people out into the wilderness, they were out there, right? They could only talk in fairly marginal forms to each other. But that one thing that had happened, right, with both the internet and Facebook and lots of social media is that it wasn't possible to do that anymore, right? They weren't in that that place where they could perform that purity role. And that became very clear in the campaign, but only in a way quite late. In the beginning of 2016, after National Review published its Against Trump issue, which was their attempt to blow Trump out of the water, and after Trump had lost so profoundly in early primary, Rich Lowry, the editor, put out a tweet with the Against Trump cover and just saying thank you or no, you're welcome. So I think they still thought fairly far into this that they were able to play this role of defining what was legitimate Republican conservatism and what was not. And only later did they realize that their ability to actually control the conservative brand had been slipping away from them.
You mentioned earlier these differences among the public intellectuals. So in this part of the book, you make clear that there isn't the same kind of thick relationships as we see with the foreign policy experts. There isn't this same sense of we're all in this together because of the cleavages within the conservative public intellectual movement. But you spend some time on this notion of ideas having consequences and the sincere feeling on the part of some public intellectuals that we were at a moment in which we were about to corrupt our Republican character. And you distinguish among the different intellectuals, finding, for example, that Jewish conservatives seemed much more sensitive to authoritarianism. And I was wondering if you could explain a little bit more about those observations and the differences that you saw.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we spent a fair amount of time talking about this group called Reformicons or Reform Conservatives, who had been for years trying to convince the Republican Party that it was becoming a working class, or at least a white working class party, and that it needed to have an economic policy that was appropriate to a working class party. And that they had been frustrated in that project. They had found the sort of more economically libertarian Koch network side of the Republican Party to really be their adversary in that project. And that one thing that was going on in the Republican primary was you had this, what you might call sort of Koch sub-primary, where the Koch network and the funders around them were putting all the candidates through their paces and trying to keep them into this pre-existing, quite libertarian economic straitjacket. And so they had, in a way, been hoping for a candidate who would have a different opinion on immigration, would have a different opinion on middle-class entitlements, would have a different opinion on protecting working-class Americans' jobs. And unfortunately for them, the person who ended up running on that was Donald Trump, who most of them found incredibly morally indigestible. But I think in some ways, for me, they were the most interesting group because they had this ambivalence. On the one hand, disliking Trump and thinking that he was a kind of poison. And on the other hand, thinking that the Republican Party had brought Trump on themselves by not listening to them earlier.
No, and that, and also earlier in the book, you talk a lot about the autopsy and the sort of reports and the thinking that had been done by other parts of the conservative movement about where the party was, where it needed to go, and to have that deliberative conversation.
Yeah, and the Reformicons had been very critical of the autopsy, which they saw as more or less just suggesting that the Republican Party needed to embrace immigration reform, to be more tolerant, and then everyone would love their economic policy. Whereas the Reformicons had exactly the opposite diagnosis. And I do think that diagnosis was mostly right, that in fact the economic policy of the Republican Party was its underlying long-term electoral problem. And now, again, I think many of them thought that it was possible to build a cross-racial working class party. And again, one of the reasons they dislike Trump is that he was making that possibility of a cross-racial working class Republican Party impossible by having such a sort of obviously blunt, racial animus.
Yeah, Steve, Susan asked about the religious component. Why don't you go back and say a word about that?
Well, and actually, you know what? Why don't we, let me restate it, because I was at the University of Chicago long enough to see the words Leo Strauss and to for my hands to shake. So you're actually describing a rather complex group of people who have very, very different influences. On the one hand, you are talking about the followers of Leo Strauss and the effect that they have had on through the universities and colleges that some of the conservative public intellectuals attended. And you're also talking about separately, I think, of Jewish conservatives as having this hypersensitivity to authoritarianism. So feel free to flesh it out in any way you'd like, but I'd love to know a little bit more about the cleavages within public intellectual.
Yeah, I mean, so again, I should just admit that I studied with Jim Caesar, who was a student of Harvey Mansfield at Harvard, and the influence of Strauss is definitely part of my intellectual armament myself. And I do think that, you know, a significant part of the conservative intellectual movement was shaped and influenced by Strauss and students of Strauss and those writings. And one thing that comes out of that is a belief in the idea that liberal democracy needs to be elevated, that its danger is that it will be drawn down into populism, into the term they would use is demagoguery. And demagoguery is a central risk of liberal democracy, and that it needs to be protected by institutions. And among those institutions, as both Harvey Mansfield and Jim Caesar have argued, are political parties that should elevate the opinion of liberal democracy rather than appeal to its basest elements. And I think so, you know, it doesn't, if you came into this with that kind of intellectual baggage and background, then you would definitely see Trump as a significant threat with that filter. And again, I think the same thing is true, as we talked about, not just of Jewish conservatives, but of Mormons, who I think were, you know, fairly important in this as well, right? The state with the largest support for Evan McMullen was, and Evan McMullen was Mormon, but was Utah. And I think one thing we talk about this in this book is what you might call the catastrophic imagination, the ability to imagine things getting much, much worse, right? And that's part of the communal experience of Jews and Mormons in a way that it's simply not for most other religious traditions in the United States. And to the degree that it was in this campaign, it cut in the opposite direction, right? Lots of Christians had come to believe that they were in that they were under threat. Their basic communal control was under threat. You think about the Flight 93 article that Michael Anton wrote that that suggested that this was, you know, the last Democratic election if Republicans lost, and therefore they needed to swallow things that they wouldn't otherwise swallow and go along with Trump. And so in a way, there was a lot of apocalypticism going on in this campaign, but among Republicans, it often cut in quite different directions.
Rob, I think you wanted to contribute something on this.
No, I think Steve covered it. I just wanted to make sure that he addressed the religious piece that you asked about earlier. So.
I mean, I think that part of the book is really good because it fleshes out this notion of American liberalism as fragile, as a fabric that if you pull out too many threads, you could see it disintegrate. And the cleavages within conservatism about just how many threads you can pull out before you do tip towards authoritarianism. And as I was reading it, I was very much reminded of Philip Roth's The Plot Against America, a book that really pushes on this feeling of Jews that they are not safe unless the institutions of liberal democracy are stable, and any sort of instability could potentially create problems for minorities like Jews or Mormons in a way that was seen very differently by others. I want to push you a little bit more on Straussianism and the role it plays here. Not everybody knows who Leo Strauss was. He was a German intellectual who emigrated to the United States during World War II. He had very particular views on the role of philosophy and how it guides us. And he also had a category of people. Some people call them the gentlemen. Some people call them the statesmen, people who are supposed to translate. And why I think that's interesting to your book is because you are showing this tension between Donald Trump, the populist, and elites who are very, very concerned with populism. So small d democracy is not something that they welcome, but something that terrifies them. And it certainly terrified Strauss. And he understood the role of these intellectuals in helping create this kind of a bulwark between what it was the public liked. But there is also a sort of gender component to Straussianism in how he understands who can be a philosopher And I was wondering about gender throughout this book. Every once in a while it would jump out. Bret Stephens gives this sort of example about pornography. There's just these sort of little moments of feeling like you're in a locker room. And I'm wondering in general about the intellectuals that you interviewed, whether they are predominantly men, what role gender played in any of the organization among either the public intellectuals or the other groups, because it, it seemed to be something that was perhaps there, but I missed more of the fullness of the argument.
Yeah, I mean, it just should be stated that for the most part, the conservative public intellectual movement is just a lot more male than it is female. So that's in social science terms, you know, that's a feature of the population rather than our sample. And we do interview a number of female Never Trumpers. Mona Charon, I think, is one of the most interesting ones in this. But they I don't think they did, you know, and again, I think for some of them, it probably was the case that just Trump's, you know, brute misogyny just made it impossible to justify him. But just to go back to the previous point, and again, I'm happy to go as far down the Straussian rabbit hole as you want to go. But I do think that at least for a particular set of conservatives, and I think, you know, Jonah Goldberg is a good example of this particular type, right? He's not a PhD in political philosophy, but he's deeply read in the history of conservatism. And, you know, so much of not just Strauss, but other parts, right? Ortega y Gasset, you know, book, The Revolt Against the Masses, right? There's a lot of anti-populism in the history of conservatism. And, you know, one of the reasons that Strauss thought that the United States was a good regime, not the best regime, which is an important distinction, but it was a good and decent regime, was that it was a regime that was based on constitutionalism, on the rule of law, on separation of powers, all these things that act as kinds of breaks against the direct transmission of popular attitudes or manias. And those are all things that Straussians who are working in American politics had tried very hard to defend. And again, you know, that's one of the reasons why Trumpism, as well as Trump, seems so threatening to them.
Yeah, and I'd maybe just jump in to also make an important and kind of core, but point here is that certainly from their perspective, that's there's nothing anti-democratic about that. It's a project of making democracy safe and preventing democracy from going off the rails and turning into something very different. Of course, some critics of Strauss and Straussianism do perceive it to be anti-democratic, and there's a whole debate we could get into over that. But I mean, for the group of people, I think that we profile in the book, for them, it's not an anti-democratic thing. It's about having a healthy democracy, right? One that avoids some of the things that have plagued democracies and destroyed democracies over the long course of human history. And so that's, I think, how they would conceive of the situation.
No, I'm sorry, Rob. I think I'm going all theorist on you. I'm distinguishing between the small d democratic and the small l liberal part of American government, such that the way I would see it is that the conservatives are very, very invested in the liberal part, but the majoritarian element has always caused conservatives to be nervous, as were the Federalists. So it's not something that I'm saying is outside of American government, and I don't mean to be using democracy in the usual way we do. So I apologize for that. Let's talk about the last part, which is about lawyers and economists. It's a very, very different story that gets told in this part of the book. And this group, these two groups, yeah, they come off very differently and as having somewhat different motives. Steve, I think you wrote this part, and so maybe you want to start us off with the lawyers?
Yeah, so the lawyers, I do think it's important to recognize that the lawyers of all these groups had just a very different relationship with Trump. There were many conservative lawyers, and again, one of my previous books was on the conservative legal movement, who were very concerned about Trump, Trump was very much their last choice. A lot of them had supported Ted Cruz, who himself was part of the conservative legal movement. But in the end, after they went through, down to their 19th favorite candidate, they got to Trump. And, one of the important things is, unlike these other groups, Trump had not openly rejected their jurisdiction. In fact, if anything, he had increased their jurisdiction during the campaign by embracing these lists of potential Supreme Court justices that had been put together by through the sort of Heritage and Federalist Society networks. And so he had, in a way, embraced them, because I think he recognized, especially through their connection with social conservatives, that they really had power, right? They didn't just have this sort of role that they were powerful because everyone believed they were powerful, right? They were powerful because they could hurt someone. And Trump openly, therefore, embraced them, said that he was basically handing over this entire function of judicial selection to them. And that froze a lot of these conservative lawyers in place. The other thing that we mentioned is that many of them just had a lesser repulsion for Trump, in that just their professional job is often defending people that they don't find particularly morally appealing. And the entire sort of professional process for understanding how you do that. And so I think they conceptualize Trump in that way as a client, and a client is a lot different than a leader. So I think that explained a lot of why they made the decisions they did. Now, there were a number of conservatives, especially in academia, who ended up being more openly opposed to Trump and the conservative legal movement. I think some of that has to do with the fact that judicial selection was a little less important to many of them, and that things like political philosophy, that the separation of powers, the role of the judiciary in a liberal democratic system all mattered to them just as much, if not more, than the judicial selection. And one thing that came up with a number of those people is they were really worried that the project of originalism, which was their intellectual project, would be forever stained by the association with Trump, and therefore that it was important to distinguish themselves from Trump as a person.
Yeah, and if I could just jump in with one little illustration that's always stood out to me on just that client serving aspect of the legal network that Steve was talking about. Just part of the job description of being a lawyer is that you represent people sometimes who you don't like or even think are bad, terrible people. And that's just fine, that it doesn't reflect on you personally, right? That's just your job. And one illustration of that was when I interviewed John Yoo, and how different that interview was from so many of the others that Steve and I did. And I was just so struck by the way that John Yoo talked about the whole Trump phenomenon in such a carefree way. And it was a huge contrast to the almost therapy session like interviews that we had with a lot of the other people who weren't lawyers, but you would talk about the experiences. It was kind of like a low stakes sports rivalry or a Coke versus Pepsi kind of debate, and his and his friends were still kind of teasing him about it and ha ha, isn't that funny kind of way. And it was just such a contrast with again, a lot of the national security people, the political professionals who for whom this was like just a huge and horrible moment in their lives. And for the lawyers, just tend not to think about it in quite that same way, as it just isn't such a personal thing for a lot of them.
Yeah, and again, the other thing I would say is that compared to the national security network, this is a very polarized group of people, right? There's very little overlap between the conservative and the left of center legal networks in a way that there's lots of those on the national security side. So where the national security side, you know, would often look at their counterparts on the other, you know, in the other party and say, you know, we disagree with them on some of these things, but you know, they're one of us. They're part of this national security establishment. This really was a either or choice, right? They thought that if Democrats won, they would fill the judiciary with lots of very left of center judges, and that would have very significant consequences for them for a very long time, that they often believe were going to be irreparable, in a way that some of the changes in these other areas really don't have that long tail that judicial selection does.
No, and one thing I really enjoyed in that chapter was the few people who felt the necessity to bind themselves, sort of a Ulysses and the Sirens moment, in which they knew that one day they would be called into the White House and be asked to do something. And in order to not be called, they put their name out publicly opposing the president, the candidate, would-be President Trump. And so you can see as you paint the picture of the lawyers, how on the one hand, they actually have something at stake. And so having this kind of durable cooperative relationship, that's a term that you use, it actually got them something. They did get the judges and that they predicted they would. And for those who were tempted, some of them at least removed that temptation. Steve, I want to ask you about the economists. They don't come off well in this book. They seem to be the one group that doesn't have much collective action, that actually doesn't have much of a response. And so I was wondering if you can say a little bit about what distinguishes the economists from these other professions.
Yeah, so on the one hand, even more arguably than the national security conservatives, Trump's entire worldview is counter to that of the modern economics profession, right? The entire modern economics profession, going back to Adam Smith, is based on the, you know, belief that the world is made up of the possibility of non-zero sum interactions between people, right? And that's true of the economy, but I think it's in a way more of a general worldview that exchange for mutual benefit is good. Both sides can win out of a interaction, whereas Trump's entire worldview is a zero-sum worldview, right? That's true in national security, where, you know, international cooperation is always just for him, another word for being exploited by foreign countries. It's true in the economy, where some sides to an interaction are losers and some are winners. That certainly was true of the economic interactions that Trump himself engaged in. So in a way, right, he had, you know, openly questioned their jurisdiction and again, quite openly didn't want to take advice from Republican economists. But on the other hand, economists simply have a very different worldview, in particular about politics, that they are much less likely to have a sort of moralized conception of government in a way that national security people do, where they really think of it as having, you know, concepts of, you know, honor are very important for conservative national security people. And the view that we sort of associate with public choice in economics, that all of politics is itself just a world of exchange that I think made them less likely to react in highly moralized ways. They were disappointed with Trump. They didn't like where he was taking his the party, where, you know, trade and other kinds of things were concerned. But they, you know, but they're also a highly individualistic group as compared to the national security people. The national security people were very comfortable exercising influence over each other and telling each other how they should, what they should do, whereas the economists tend to be much more individualistic and much more likely to simply act on their own rather than to act through forms of collective action.
So let's turn to the conclusion of the book. Realize that you published this before many of the events that are before us happened. First, I want to start with a question from a student. We have some students working with the podcast this summer, and Benjamin Warren wants to know from you whether you thought that Never Trump was doomed from the beginning, or there was a strategy that could have been used to stop Trump, something that wasn't considered or was considered but wasn't implemented.
Yeah, I'll take that. I mean, you know, I mean, it depends on what you think happened on election day in 2016, right? If you think that what happened is that Trump got an inside straight and a huge number of things all fell in exactly the right way on that particular day, and that if you reran the, you know, if you reran the program, you know, 20 times, that it would flip to Hillary Clinton, 17 or 18 times, you might say, well, this is a great strategy, right? And if Hillary Clinton had won and Trump had lost, then we would probably all be telling the history very differently. And we would say what a bunch of strategic geniuses these guys were. And they were the ones who were there to sort of pick up the Republican mantle. And people would have all been saying that populism was a big mistake. So in that sense, right, you know, obviously they were wrong in the sense that they lost, but it's not necessarily the case that given the information they had and given the probabilities that they didn't have a entirely plausible strategy. Again, you know, what if they had gotten a much more plausible candidate than Evan McMullen, right? They were very close. History is often made up of a bunch of these, you know, accidents and contingencies. And so it's always easy to go and rerun this and say that, well, if they'd only done this or that, right? Most of these guys did, and they're mostly men, as you mentioned before, you know, they did most of what, you know, they used most of the ammo that was at hand. It wasn't like they left a lot on the battlefield, but they were quite limited. They were quite limited financially, because I think most of the anti-Trump donors were in fact quite worried about what Trump would do to them personally if he won. So I do think, you know, they didn't leave a lot on the battlefield, but they had only limited resources to deploy.
As I understood the book, you don't simply see them actually as having failed because you see some sort of long-term effects potentially on the Republican Party, on conservatism, even on the Democratic Party, and on American constitutionalism as a regime. I'm wondering if we could just end with of what you see in the long haul as the effect of Never Trump.
Yeah, so I can take this and then Rob can jump in. So we argue in the conclusion of the book, and as you know, as you do tons and tons of these interviews, and you always know the conclusion is usually the worst part of the book. And so we very much wanted to avoid that by just sort of summarizing what we had already argued. And what we did instead was to do a kind of exercise in futurism to imagine what would be a scenario in which these Never Trumpers would not simply be a kind of marginal force, but would actually be relevant. And we argue that that future in which they're relevant is a future in which the parties are much more durably factionalized than they have been recently, that is divided into organized groups who negotiate with one another, who have their own financial bases, geographic bases, interest group bases, intellectual foundations, and that the parties are much more heterogeneous internally. You're already very much seeing that in the Democratic Party, right? As you have an actual Democratic Socialist faction, the Democratic Party, they're putting up candidates, they're winning. Wasn't just AOC, it was this more this recent primary. Some of those candidates are winning. They've got their own intellectual organizations, their own ways of raising money online. And that we think that something like that is probably going to come to the Republican Party, where the sort of Trumpist populist faction is probably going to be the majority faction, but that they won't be able to win political power without a minority faction that's competitive where that populist faction is not. You already see this in Republican governors in states like Maryland and Massachusetts, where Republicans can win with a different kind of message. If people with money and intellectuals and other people actually formed a discrete faction and ran candidates and developed a different brand in the way that the Democratic Leadership Council did in the 80s and 90s, that you can imagine the Republican Party becoming a more heterogeneous party, and the Never Trumpers would really be the sort of intellectual grounding of that minority but pivotal faction in the Republican Party.
Add that, you know, a more factionalized party system is normal if you look back over American history, right? That's been the usual state of affairs. You know, we have a two-party system, and you know, everyone likes to talk about third parties, but for all kinds of structural reasons, that's just very hard. You know, there's a reason we haven't had a new party since come on the scene and since the 1850s, and so the way our system has typically addressed the demand out there for more than just two options is through intra-party factions. And what's notable about the last several decades is the absence of those factions. So it's not at all crazy to think that we could be primed for a return to that. And as Steve points out, you know, we can already see the outlines of that. I'd also say, you know, for these Never Trumpers, there's a reason why they were and are Republicans, right? It's not just so easy for them to switch over to the Democratic Party. They are conservatives, and so once Trump is off the scene, whenever that happens, it's not just so easy for them to say, well, we're done with the Republican Party, and you know, they've got to land somewhere. But to kind of highlight a point Steve made in passing, you know, we do spin this out as a scenario, right? There's no iron law of social science that says this is going to happen. If it happens, it's going to require that individuals make choices to turn their energies in the direction of building the institutions for in intra-party factions, as opposed to kind of going down what we tend to see as kind of rabbit holes of trying to develop a third party or something like that. So individual agency is going to matter.
Well, I want to thank you both for taking the time to talk with me today. I read this week while the story of John Bolton and his book and was spilling out, and I think it's extremely relevant for heading into the November election. And I recommend it to all our listeners. Robert Saldine and Stephen Tellis's book is Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites, published by Oxford University Press in 2020. It's available on the Oxford University website. It's available on Barnes & Noble and Amazon. It's also available through bookshop.org, which will allow you to support brick and mortar bookstores that are not yet open during the pandemic, and they will mail it directly to you. So thank you so much, Rob. Thank you so much, Steve. And I guess we'll all be watching this incredibly interesting and important election coming this fall.
Thank you, Susan.
Thanks, Susan.